Hello, and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. Just one guest today, Kianga Yamada Taylor, who talks about her excellent book, From Black Lives Matter to Black Liberation. Taylor's book places BLM into the context of the history of radical black politics in the U.S. and suggests how it might move from a powerful phenomenon into a seriously transformative movement. She is an assistant professor of African American Studies at Princeton. Her next book, Race for Profit, Black Housing and the Urban Crisis of the 1970s, will look at the turn to market-based solutions after the uprisings of the 1960s, specifically Washington's promotion of single-family homeownership in black communities. As her Princeton faculty bio says, Taylor is interested in the role of private sector forces, typically hidden in public policymaking and execution, in the urban crisis of the 1970s. Her current book, From Black Lives Matter to Black Liberation, was published a couple of months ago by Haymarket. Kianga Yamada Taylor. A lot of people thought on the election of Barack Obama that we'd entered the post-racial society, the magical moment in 2008 when everyone thought that was happening. Clearly that didn't happen. Gary Wills said in his book on Nixon that the reason the 60s exploded was because in the 50s all the liberals and intellectuals thought it's all the fault of Eisenhower. And if we could just get our guy in there, things will be much, much better. And they got Kennedy in there, who was their kind of guy, and things still were pretty terrible. And people decided, well, it's the system, and that is why the 60s happened. Do you think there is something like that with the Obama presidency, that expectations among black Americans in particular were raised so much, and then his disappointment was actually kind of productive?
Yeah, I certainly think that there's an element of that dynamic at play. For younger African Americans in particular, really the people who have fueled the Black Lives Matter movement, for a number of those people who we have to remember are coming of age in the first two presidencies of George W. Bush, the era of Hurricane Katrina and the kind of collective shrug of the federal government in response to that, to the emergent mobilizations around the Gina Six, which were six young black people who had been a part of an anti-racist campaign in Louisiana. All of these things contributed to the expectation that the Obama administration would be substantively different from what many of these young people had experienced during the Bush years. And so some people's reaction to that is that's incredibly naive. And whether or not that's an accurate description, I think that we have to distinguish between candidate Obama and President Obama, who has governed much further to the right than candidate Obama, who consciously tried to tap into not just the anger and disillusionment of this generation of black people, but also into the hope and expectation that things would be different. I mean, Obama went out of his way to craft his candidacy as something akin to a social movement. He made allusions to his candidacy and his eventual presidency being the fruition of King's dream. There was a very deliberate attempt to cultivate an image of the candidacy of Barack Obama as being the solution to the hardships that people had endured over the course of the Bush administration. And so young black people bought into that and voted in historically high numbers for the Obama campaign. What we're witnessing now is really the fallout with the dashed expectations of young black people with the Obama administration. I think the emergence of Black Lives Matter under his administration is the most clear evidence of that dynamic being displayed.
Obama, of course, is now the most successful and prominent of the whole class of black politicians over the last five decades or so. You write about the movement of the 60s that after its revolutionary potential was exhausted or repressed by the state, a combination of both, I guess, extreme repression by the state, that there was a shift towards electoral politics. That hasn't quite worked out with the hopes that people invested in it in the late 60s, early 70s, has it?
Well, no. I think that in some ways we've come, probably not in reality, but at least figuratively, we've come to the end of that. I think the the showdown in Baltimore in April of 2015 was quite telling about the fruitlessness of this particular strategy in Black politics right now, so that when you have a Black mayor who is calling upon her Black police chief, who is calling upon a Black general in the National Guard to put down a rebellion of young Black people, that we really have entered into a new phase of Black politics and this idea of Black solidarity across class lines, and that there is some particular type of what Michael Dawson would call linked fate or continued affection and allegiance that goes without qualification between the Black political elite and ordinary Black people has been seriously fractured and damaged. I don't think that we can say that it no longer exists, because I think that part of Hillary Clinton's success among the small number of African Americans who are participating in the primaries has a lot to do with the Clintons' long relationship with the Black political establishment and their ability to continue to have a hearing, particularly among older Black voters. But for young Black people, the generation of African Americans who are politically becoming more cynical about the political system and who are looking to other forms of participation and activism to challenge the conditions that they and their families live in, that the sort of unqualified, unquestioned support for Black elected officials no longer exists. And so I think that this class divide that then takes on political expression among African Americans is as deep and divisive as it has ever been over the last 45 or 50 years.
And not just elected officials, but people like Al Sharpton.
Correct.
Sharpton's role in Ferguson and around protests has been not exactly sterling, has it?
Well, no, I think that it, in many ways it crystallized the dissolution of this particular strategy. And I think it also crystallized the way that these divisions go beyond just questions of generation and move into the realm of class. I mean, Sharpton showed up in Ferguson, and to be honest, as he's shown up in many places before, because families have called upon him because of his proximity to the White House, his proximity to Black political power as a way to bring attention to the unjust murder of their loved ones. So, you know, Black people have consistently called on Al Sharpton in the absence of a political movement. But in Ferguson, he ran into a completely different situation where young people in particular had taken it upon themselves to keep the case of Mike Brown alive and to really express an outrage against their own treatment by the Ferguson police, which we only saw a very small amount of with the kind of standoff between the hyper-militarized Ferguson police and the Black population there. But what we would later come to find out is how these same police and local officials had literally been preying financially on the Black community. And we got some more insight into the deep wells of bitterness that existed among African Americans that put into more context why Ferguson. This question kept erupting. Why Ferguson? Why did this happen here? And so Al Sharpton shows up on the scene in this situation and tries to throw his weight around. And when people are non-responsive, really the mask of Al Sharpton is ripped off, where he goes into a racist tirade against the young protesters in Ferguson and is really apoplectic that he can't just come in and take over. And so this wasn't just a question of generation, which comes up in the emergence of any new social movement, where you have young people who aren't weighted down by the failures of the past and who are more willing to take chances. And then you have an older generation of activists who are more cautious because of the failures in the past. This wasn't just a question of that. It was really Sharpton wanting to use his insider status in the White House to calm a situation down, which would secure his position as a particular kind of interlocutor with the black community. And young black people who were angry and wanted to confront the Ferguson political establishment and the police on their own terms and didn't feel like they needed an interlocutor to articulate their contempt, frustration, fury with the system, that they could do that directly themselves.
I'm speaking with Kianga Yamada Taylor, author of From Black Lives Matter to Black Liberation from Haymarket Books. Yeah, and this was perceived as a generational conflict, and a lot of people are saying the kids were being rude to their elders, but in part that's the role of what younger people are supposed to do. They're supposed to be rude and upset things a bit. And us older people, we have wisdom to offer, but we also should listen to what younger people have to say. But you have a passage in your book where you describe Sharpton's 60th birthday party at the Four Seasons Hotel, sponsored by the likes of AT&T and Walmart. So there's this is not purely generational. There's some really serious class stuff going on here.
It gives you some insight. I mean, the birthday party was completely ridiculous, where basically Sharpton invited different corporate entities to buy ad space in the program for his birthday party that helped him pull his organization, the National Action Network, out of debt. And so really, you see Sharpton's role is trying to contain political protest and trying to keep it as narrowly focused as possible. And I think that this is where a lot of the conflict between this newer emergent generation of activists were developing compared to some of the veterans of the movement. The public discussion was about elders versus young people and whether or not people are rude or respectful. But really, this came down to, can we keep this protest as narrowly focused on a particular case of police brutality as possible, or, as these young people were doing, we want to generalize this beyond the antics or actions of particular police officers, but look at how this is a systemic problem, not just with the police, but with the criminal justice system as a whole. But we also must raise questions about the role of the police in the society in general and connect brutal policing to other aspects of brutality in our lives, whether that's poverty, whether it's chronic unemployment, whether it's a whole host of problems that people have endured in the United States. And so that discussion becomes much more precarious for people who are concerned about selling ad space to McDonald's, to AT&T, who are concerned about their proximity to political power in the White House, who are concerned about their ability to have a cable news program, so on and so forth. You don't really want to be connected to a radical movement when you have all of these other kinds of economic and political concerns at stake. And even the Congressional Black Caucus, when they showed up to Ferguson, their primary concern was really about how to transform the anger of young black people from street protest into voter registration drives. And so this demonstrated a complete disconnect with what was actually happening in the streets. It demonstrated a complete lack of recognition of the realities of young black people to even understand why they were so angry in the first place. That, yes, they were angry about the murder of Mike Brown, but they were also angry about having arrest warrants for parking tickets, about being fined continuously by the Ferguson Police Department with the sanctioning of the Ferguson political establishment. They were frustrated about being preyed upon by the police. And so the lack of recognition of this, or the willingness to confront that and to confront the police and police power, is what really created the gap, not generation, but a total experiential gap between black political elites, or part of the black political establishment, both in its formal and informal capacities, and the lives of ordinary black people on a day-to-day basis. There was a complete disconnect, and Sharpton's experience in Ferguson helped to articulate that more clearly than anything else had in recent memory.
This points to something that a lot of white people don't think about very much, but the class divisions in the black community in many ways are starker than they are among whites, aren't they?
Yeah, the gap between the richest black people and the poorest black people are much more significant and profound than between the richest white people and poorest white people. We're still talking about a relatively small group of people, but it does lead to a completely different set of experiences in day-to-day life, which I think that we've seen through the last year and a half lead to completely different political conclusions as well in terms of how do you respond to them. Because for the richest black people, obviously there are aspects of this society that have worked for them. And so it means that you're still willing to politically engage, that you feel like there is a place for you in this society, you know, which totally makes sense. But for the vast majority of African Americans who have seen their economic situation, the social conditions and the neighborhoods and communities they live in either stagnate or deteriorate over the last decade, there's much more skepticism. There's much more frustration with the status quo. And so this also expresses itself politically. And I think that this is some of what we've seen in the explosions around Black Lives Matter, particularly in a place like Baltimore.
I always think of that. There's, I think, a footnote in Capital Volume 3 where Marx says, the better a ruling class is able to absorb the natural leaders of the oppressed, the more solid and dangerous its rule. And that seems like the black political class has played that role very well.
Well, I do think that this was part of the strategy, not just among some African Americans in the 1960s, but certainly among the ruling elite in the country, which was after several years of rebellions in the 1960s, which, you know, we're not talking about a small number of people. We're talking about their estimates of over 500,000 African Americans engaged in rioting and rebellion of some sort or another throughout that period. And so the question becomes whether or not we continue to let this happen or whether or not we allow the space for the development of a black middle class and that we turn the Democratic Party in some ways into a party that is seen as a legitimate place for black people to engage in politics. So the Democratic Party actually changes its rules to absorb more black activists, women activists, and young people and youth student activists into the party as delegates. There is a viewpoint that if we have African Americans at the helm of many of these cities that have been flashpoints of violence and rebellion, that will have a cooling impact on that. And so we go into the 70s with this perspective of absorbing African-American activists into the formal political regime of Democratic Party politics. And I think that this strategy, as I said earlier, has really reached in some ways. It's not to say that it won't continue to perpetuate itself in some ways, but it's really reached its end as a kind of argument that this leads to the actual empowerment of ordinary black people. I think that it's clear that it leads to the empowerment and enrichment of a certain group of African Americans, but that you can see that over the last 30 or 40 years, as the number of black elected officials has continued to rise, the actual conditions, wages, wealth accumulation, the social conditions in black communities for that ordinary working class black people and poor black people live in have either stayed the same or have stagnated. And so the argument that there is some sort of correlation between black entry into formal politics and the development of a black political class somehow leads to the empowerment or enrichment of ordinary Black people has no basis in reality. And so that raises new questions, I think, about where the Black movement then goes. It raises questions about solidarity. If we can no longer make this argument about interracial solidarity across class lines, then who will Black people ally with? It raises a whole number of questions about the strategy and tactics that underlie the continued struggle for Black liberation.
We're listening to Kianga Yamada Taylor, Assistant Professor of African American Studies at Princeton and author of From Black Lives Matter to Black Liberation from Haymarket Books. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back with a second part of the Taylor interview after this musical break.
A rat done bit my sister Nell with Whitey on the moon. Her face and arms began to swell, and Whitey's on the moon. I can't pay no doctor bills, but Whitey's on the moon. 10 years from now, I'll be paying still while Whitey's on the moon. You know, the man just upped my rent last night, cause Whitey's on the moon. No hot water, no toilets, no lights, but Whitey's on the moon. I wonder why he's upping me, cause Whitey's on the moon. Well, I was already giving him 50 a week, and now Whitey's on the moon. Taxes taking my whole damn check. The junkies make me a nervous wreck. The price of food is going up. And as if all that crap wasn't enough, a rat done bit my sister Nell with Whitey on the moon. Her face and arms began to swell, and Whitey's on the moon. Was all that money I made last year for Whitey on the moon? How come I ain't got no money here? Whitey's on the moon.
That was some of Gil Scott-Heron's Whitey on the Moon, which Kianga Yamada Taylor mentions in this interview. And now the second, concluding part of my interview with Taylor, author of From Black Lives Matter to Black Liberation. I want to return to that in a moment, but let's go back to the rebellions of the 60s. Certainly people remember riot. Well, actually, I don't know what people remember these days, but there were urban riots, rebellions. But there were also some really serious organized political activity, and a lot of it was explicitly anti-capitalist and socialist, which we have many of us have forgotten about. Talk some about the political program of the Black Panther Party and what reaction it inspired in the American ruling class.
The first thing I would say is that there was a relationship between the Black rebellions and the development of Black political organization. I mean, and I think it's important to say, because there's always this kind of dismissiveness of rebellions and riotous behavior. We saw it again in Baltimore with these stupid questions about why people are burning down their communities, and never making the connection between the fact that we're actually now having a national discussion about conditions in Baltimore as a result of the rebellion that happened there, whereas some people couldn't find Baltimore on a map prior to that discussion. And so in the 1960s, the rebellions really gave lie to all sorts of discussions about what the United States actually was. Was this a democracy? Was this the affluent society that should be dictating to the rest of the world what they should be doing? Because the United States' own conception of itself as the greatest country on earth somehow gave its leadership the authority to dictate what everyone else in the world should be doing. It gave it its authority to launch wars in far-flung places of the globe. And so the Black Rebellion at home gave lie to the idea that the United States should be in a position to dictate what anyone should be doing when it couldn't even ensure basic democratic rights for its Black population at home. And so I think that the rebellion also gave confidence for the organization of Black political resistance that would carry in some ways the spirit of the rebellion forward. And so the most dramatic expression of that, of course, was the Black Panther Party, which this year is the 50th anniversary of its formation. And the Black Panthers were in many ways the highest expression of socialist consciousness in the United States, even with a relatively small organization of around 5,000 people, but whose political reach went into the hundreds of thousands. I mean, at one point in the early 1970s, they were selling somewhere between 150 and 200,000 copies a week of their newspaper, The Black Panther Speaks, in which you could find through the pages of the newspaper a critique of American capitalist society, an organization that really organized itself around its 10-point platform, which basically called for reparations of some sort for Black people, the immediate release of political prisoners, the demand for food, clothing, housing, education, all of those things that did not exist and continue to not exist in any meaningful way for African Americans, that this went out to hundreds of thousands of people, and I think for a period of time shaped the political consciousness of a significant portion of not just Black people, but people in general who were concerned with issues of social justice. And I think that when people say that socialism, and this has come up this year in particular because of the somewhat chilly response that Bernie Sanders has received from Black voters, that socialism is just not an issue that Black people are concerned with. It betrays an enormous ignorance about the history of Black radical politics, of Black radicalism in this country, where really African Americans have been at the heart of the socialist movement and the socialist tradition for most of the 20th century.
No, that was true of the Communist Party in the 1930s, too.
No, it was absolutely true of the Communist Party in the 1930s, and again in the 1960s. And one of the lessons we should draw from that is the extreme response that the federal government, that the U.S. government takes in reaction to the growth and development of socialist movements in the United States, particularly when they begin to take up the question of racism. And so it leads to this particular dynamic, so that after the 1930s, we get this extreme reaction, repression of the socialist movement, so that when the new movement develops in the 1960s, that there's been a disconnect, a cutoff between the traditions that developed in the 1930s and the new movement. And so we get a movement that has all the vibrancy of young people active in it, but with not the same kind of history and rootedness in the previous political period. And so in the late 1960s and early 1970s, once again, we have the brutal physical repression of the movement on the one hand, the co-optation and absorption of other aspects of the movement on the other, so that today there's very few links between the previous period of struggle and today. And so there's the feeling of constantly having to reinvent the wheel instead of building on the continuity of political movements that preceded it. And that is very intentional. And that's where this idea that there's no history of Black involvement in the socialist movement comes from. It's part of a deliberate strategy to stamp out that history. And so that was certainly one of the things I was thinking about when I was writing the book, is that we have to reestablish those links and those connections, that the socialist movement in the United States in many ways is a Black movement, and we have to reestablish that history.
The uprising of the 60s helped inspire the crackdown, the war on crime, that certainly had its roots in the Johnson administration. People always blame Nixon for it, but it had its roots in the Johnson administration, and then, of course, was intensified by Nixon. Talk about that war on crime and its relation to political protest.
Well, no, absolutely. It has continued to reverberate today, but I think that in the absence of any real solution to the problems of poverty and to the social problems that develop out of that, the United States has made a decision since really the 1960s to rely on law and order to fill the breach. In some ways, it's in the 60s, there's an effort to develop further on the welfare state that was begun in the 1930s, but this time with an actual eye towards including African Americans. When you get the raised expectations that come from living in the richest country in the history of the world, and the gap that exists between what is on offer through welfare programs, if you can even call them that, and what the rest of the society has to offer, you get an extreme explosion of rage, which is in part what the rebellions of the 1960s were in response to, that we live in this rich country that can send Whitey to the moon, that can send troops halfway across the world to fight for democracy, and our children live with the threat of being killed by rats, that we live in expensive tenement, broken down, distressed housing, that we can't get jobs that pay us enough to take care of ourselves, that can't pay us enough to take care of our families. And so people explode in reaction to that. And the response isn't a further expansion, not just of the welfare state, but of creating actual livable incomes for people, creating decent housing for people. The response is law and order. And I think that response, and we see it today as well, where there is no attempt to deal with the social crises created by poverty. And so the way that you deal with poverty is by actually transferring wealth from the richest people to the poorest people. And so instead of that, we get policing and more policing.
It's almost as if the, you know, the ruling class sees that the reforms of the Great Society raise expectations, and that's very dangerous. So you don't want to do that.
Well, you don't want to do that because you can raise expectations, but if there's no actual plan to fulfill them, because what they like to say in this country, they've been saying it since the 70s, Barack Obama said it most recently, I think last year, was that we can create opportunity, but we can't guarantee outcomes. So we can supposedly give you all of these chances to be successful, but we can't actually guarantee you a decent place to live. We can't guarantee you a job with living wages. We can't guarantee you anything. The system isn't even set up to create the so-called opportunities that all of these people like to talk about. And that does create frustration, and it creates bitterness, especially, again, when you live in such a rich country and that richness is flaunted in your face all the time, whether it is in just the affluence that is on display in popular culture, or whether it's the United States spending billions of dollars a year in war and occupation or to give to the government of Israel. And so you see that there's money everywhere. There are resources everywhere except for you. And then on top of it, then you're blamed for the conditions that you live in. This is a very explosive combination. And with no promise to actually attend to those conditions, poor people, working class people, get the police. The police are the public policy of last resort. It's the last public institution standing. And that is what people have gotten instead of access to American affluence. And it's a very explosive set of circumstances.
I'm speaking with Kianga Yamada Taylor, author of From Black Lives Matter to Black Liberation, from Haymarket Books. In the early 70s, the prison population was dwindling, and people were actually talking about the end of incarceration or something like it, and then suddenly it started taking off and exploded into the 80s and through the 90s until recent years. Why do you suppose the objections to it really took flower over the last few years, even though this has been building for all these decades?
Well, I think that there have been objections, things that we can point to throughout. We look at the end of the 1970s into the 80s. There's a rebellion, a 60s-style rebellion in poor and working-class black community in Miami. There are protests against rising prison population, even in the 1970s. So someone like Manning Marable in the late 1970s, early 80s is beginning to write about the rising prison population. You know, in the early 1990s, in 1992, there's the Los Angeles Rebellion that is certainly in response to police misconduct, police brutality. And so there are these sorts of political mobilizations on a small scale throughout in response to this. Part of the problem is the role of black elected officials. The Congressional Black Caucus actually supports the Reagan administration's Anti-Drug Act, which really is the formal declaration of the war on drugs. The CBC largely supports that. It's a complex story that's not just about Uncle Tom's and sellouts. I think that there was real concern in black communities about the growing use of drugs and the crime surrounding the drug trade in black communities. But once again, when people are given no options, we have this problem with drugs and the drug trade. So therefore, we want to create gainful employment in the conventional job market. We want to create programs that give our young people some hope in the future. We want to create schools and school curriculums. No, there's none of that. There's nothing on offer except law and order, more policing, prison. That is what people are reacting to. And so you have black elected officials, blacks who are either governing the cities or who are involved in the federal government, who are also not in a position to advocate for social programs. They actually are in a position, but that is not the political tenor of the moment. And they're not trying to disrupt the political status quo. They're trying to fit in. They're trying to become a part of the political establishment, not be on the outside. And that meant instead of challenging the status quo in black cities across the country, it meant falling in line. It meant protecting the status quo, which of course leads them to advocate for the same sorts of law and order politics and policies that everyone else was advocating, including someone like Jesse Jackson, who chastised the Reagan and Bush administrations for making cuts to the National Guard, which imperiled the National Guard's ability to patrol our borders and to keep drugs out. In the 1988 run for president with Jesse Jackson, he had a kind of top 10 plan, and half of the first four or five things on that list were all about strengthening the war on drugs. And so I think that this is coming in a context of budget cuts, spending cuts, and these black elected officials were not trying to challenge that, but were really trying to go with the flow. The end result, of course, is that we get no social response to what is really a real legitimate drug crisis in inner cities across the country, and only a punishing response, a penal response, is what is on offer. We continue to see that today, the same dynamic is black politicians acting like any other politician, which is defense of the status quo and not rocking the boat.
Black Lives Matter really did grab the nation by its lapels and force people to pay attention in ways that have not, they have not in a long time. But is that enough? Can this go from a hashtag to an organized movement?
It has to. I think that
I feel very old-fashioned asking that question, but
it's okay. It's the question that confronts every movement, right? Because we've gone in the last year and a half from the movement has done a tremendous amount to expose the range of police violence and to expose its systemic roots, which is to say that any thinking person in this country no longer believes that police brutality is just the case of a rogue cop here or there, a bad apple, you know, a situation that got out of control.
Police forces are no longer all white. They're very diverse now, and it's a complicated problem. It's about the role of the police in this society.
Right. And so the movement, it hasn't gone that far. I don't think most people are questioning whether we should have police or the role of the police. But it's legitimate now that people see that there are systemic problems with policing that can't just be dealt with by a sensitivity training here or there. You think about a city like Chicago, where Rahm Emanuel's handpicked commission released its report. And this commission was the subject of protests because people wanted community representation on it, didn't get it. So it's a bunch of handpicked people from Rahm Emanuel. This commission report comes out 2 weeks ago and says point blank that the Chicago Police Department have no regard for the lives of people of color in the city of Chicago. It is a shocking statement that is impossible to have imagined without Black Lives Matter. However, we have now reached the point where that's no longer good enough. It was good enough to expose the movement, very good at exposing the problems of police brutality, but now what we are witnessing is the resilience of the political establishment to protect, to coddle its corrupt police forces, its killer cops. I mean, there are some cops who get caught, and now city governments have to, quote unquote, do something about it. But in terms of deep systemic changes, we're seeing the resistance to that. There's all kinds of evidence that point to this. Even in Chicago, where this incendiary report comes out, Rahm Emanuel's response, first, is no response. He doesn't say anything publicly for about a week. And then the response is, well, we'll take up maybe a third of the recommendations of the commission. We can see it when Obama's commission, his national commission report, came out, I don't know, 14 months ago, with 59 recommendations to, quote unquote, improve policing in the 21st century. They haven't implemented any of it. And it's because the report itself and the commission itself had no mechanism or money to implement any of it. We can see the resilience of the system and the fact that since January, the police have killed, on average, 80 people a month since January. And on and on. In San Francisco, you have judges protecting neo-Nazis who are on the police force, who are texting each other about hanging niggers, spaying niggers, and they can't be fired. The police chief tried to fire him, and a court stepped in and said, no, you can't fire him. The system, the status quo, the political establishment is digging in around its racist killer cops, and I think it's because that's the solution. That is the solution to the problems in all of these cities, is unleashing the police. The police are not out of control. The police have been unleashed. And in lieu of creating any sort of social programs, spending, any jobs, that remains the solution. Because of this, it means that the movement actually has to change its tactics. You know, 6 or 7 people stopping traffic, having a protest, that kind of thing, it's not good enough. I mean, and I'm in solidarity with every action, all actions that people take to try to confront the system. But we have to think bigger. We have to think more broadly. And we have to think about what actually can be done to not just bring attention to the problems of police violence and police brutality, but what can we do to challenge it, to actually take the police out of contact with people? How can we organize around decriminalization? How can we attack the grotesque amount of money that goes to police departments? In Chicago, where the city government likes to close schools, where they've closed over 50 schools in the last 3 years, the police get 40% of the operating budget. That's a crime in and of itself. How do we stop that? And police unions. How do we get rid of police unions and their corrupt contracts, which codify illegal, brutal police behavior? These are the kinds of things that we have to start talking about, and getting the movement back on the streets in an organized way, with larger, more disruptive demonstrations that are bringing tens of thousands, not dozens, but tens of thousands of people back onto the streets.
And finally, this is a complicated subject, but you don't want to be like one of these people who say all lives matter, you know, banalize and blunt, right, blunt the critique. But on the other hand, the number of white people killed by cops, mm-hmm, the number of white people behind bars in the U.S. is off the charts when you compare it to other countries. So how can you make this a multiracial movement without losing the sharpness of the fact that black people are just way disproportionately victimized by the police carceral state?
Well, that's part of the argument of how do we build a bigger, broader movement, because I feel like that is fundamental, that is a fundamental thing that we have to do. And it means a few things. One, it means connecting with other groups of oppressed people who endure state violence. That includes the immigrant movement, the undocumented movement. It includes reaching out and developing alliances with organizations and activist projects that are engaged against Islamophobia, so reaching out to Muslim and Arab organizations. And it also means, I think, politically making the argument that there is a place, that there is an important place for white working class and poor white people in this movement. And I write some about this in the book, that as you say, compared to every other country on earth, the rate at which the United States arrests and imprisons white people is unprecedented. When we talk about the disproportionate ways that police kill African Americans, particularly young black men, but if we look at the numbers of people, and I estimate, based on studies open to the public that I've seen, that the police in the last almost 10 years have killed around 11,000 people, that most of those people are white people that the police have killed. And so there is an argument to be made about ordinary white people being included into this movement, that they need to be involved in this movement as well. And I think that this isn't about finding the common denominator that creates the least amount of controversy and turbulence within the movement. So it's not about watering down the politics to build a broader movement. It's about raising the level of politics. That white people need to not just be involved in a movement against police violence, because police violence also happens against white people, but it's understanding how racism may be black people's burden to bear in particular, but racism is every working person's problem in this country. If we consider that the way that the U.S. uses racism to justify its prison system, its ever-widening criminal justice system, and the fact that the U.S. will spend $80 billion a year to maintain that system, that is a problem for all ordinary people, because that money is not going to schools, to hospitals, to any public expenditures that could improve the quality of life of every ordinary person in this country. It's going to keep people in prison. And the way they get away with it is using racism. We could see it in the debates around welfare reform in the late 1990s, when Bill Clinton led the charge to end welfare reform. The most visible recollection of that period is Clinton signing his Personal Responsibility Act, which was the welfare reform act in the Rose Garden in 1996, and surrounding himself with black women to do it. Meanwhile, Clinton probably knew, but what the general public probably did not know, was that the majority of people on welfare at that time were white women. And white women stood the most to lose from the attacks on welfare at that time. And so we see the way that racism is used to justify budget cuts and to justify a social order in this country that is punitive and abusive disproportionately towards black people, but that has an impact on all people who are not rich and wealthy and part of the 1%. And so on that basis, it is in our best interest to try and build the broadest movement possible, again, not on the lowest common denominator that creates the least amount of political waves, but on a high level, on winning white people in particular, to anti-racism, to having them understand the way that racism not just destroys the lives of black people, but how it imperils their own lives and their own situation. And that really is the challenge of our movement in the next period. How do we get bigger? How do we get broader to not just expose these problems, but to actually have a material impact and transform them?
That was Kianga Yamada Taylor, Assistant Professor of African American Studies at Princeton and author of From Black Lives Matter to Black Liberation from Haymarket Books. Not only is the book a great exposition of how BLM could become a broadly transformative movement, it's also a great primer on the history of black radicalism in the 20th century. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this lovely piece of music with no overt political content, one of Haydn's marvelous piano trios, which I just discovered. This is the first movement of number 41, performed by the Beaux-Arts Trio. Till next week, bye.